Thanks for joining me again.
I'm James Curran. I'm Professor of Modern History here at Sydney University and also the International Editor at the Australian Financial Review, where I write regularly about Australia in world affairs.
Well, in this and the previous episode, we've been talking about Australia and her response to the national independence movements in Southeast Asia. And I said in the last episode that it was this issue which above all dominated Australian defence and foreign policy during the 1950s and 60s. That it was in this period that the Southeast Asia, which we know today, assumed the essentials of its present shape. I also stressed that just as Washington and London gave first priority to the global Cold War, consigning Southeast Asia to a peripheral role, so Australia was happy to leave the global issues to the Americans and British and to focus its energies on the near north. While the Australians were, like the Americans and British, troubled by the spread of worldwide communism, they were more broadly concerned about the reordering of the region and the form that this would ultimately take. Those Asian regimes which were communist, most notably the People's Republic of China, were depicted in the language of dread. Instead of the Yellow Peril, Australia now feared Red China, which was demonised in political debates and the mainstream media. To illustrate Australia's response to Southeast Asia, we've been looking at three major problems associated with the national independence movements: the Indonesian struggle for independence and the fate of West New Guinea. And I showed in that previous episode that Australia was forced to acquiesce to the will and the power of her great and powerful friends in allowing Indonesia to annex West New Guinea. And I made the point that this had consequences for Australia's understanding of its alliance with the United States and their expectations of it. It prompted defence policymakers to conceive of situations where Australia would have to act independently of their allies. Now, in this episode today, I'm looking at the two other major foreign problems for Australia in this period. Problems which became so intertwined that they more or less have to be dealt with together. And they are the Indonesian confrontation with Malaysia over the future of the British territories in Borneo, Sarawak, and British North Borneo, and the communist-led Vietnamese nationalist movement in the Vietnam War. Now, almost at the very moment of the Indonesian success in West New Guinea, two new issues emerged which threatened the whole region. From the Australian point of view, these developments in Southeast Asia threatened immediately and dangerously Australia's national security. The first of these developments was Indonesia's hostility to the Malayan and British governments' agreement to solve the problem of the decolonisation of the British Crown colonies in Borneo by incorporating them with Singapore into a Malaysian federation. The second was the intensification of communist-led guerrilla activities in Indochina, especially South Vietnam, which threatened the survival of the pro-Western Diem regime, which the Americans had installed in Saigon after the division of the country in 1954. Behind both these developments, the Australian government saw the expansionist ambitions of communist China. It was believed that if South Vietnam fell, then it would precipitate a domino effect which would extend China's communist influence, if not direct control, to the very borders of Australia. It would encourage President Sukarno's militancy in Borneo and even possibly engineer a communist coup in Indonesia. Thus, the Australians, from their own perspective and in their own way, stood with the British and the Americans in their efforts to defeat these insurgencies. Above all, the Australians wanted to maintain a Southeast Asia that was well disposed to and dependent on its great and powerful friends. Now, while these two issues, Indonesia's confrontation of Malaysia and the Vietnam War, while those two issues were linked, nevertheless, they are quite distinct in their origin and nature. So let me look first at the problem of confrontation. Now, this emerged from the proposal by the Malayan Prime Minister Tunku Abdul Rahman in May 1961 for what he called an understanding between Malaya, Singapore, and the British territories on the island of Borneo, that is, the colonies of North Borneo, Sarawak, and the Sultanate of Brunei. And this understanding very quickly turned into the idea of creating a new federation which would be known as Malaysia. Now, the British agreed to this proposal, and they saw in the idea of a Malaysian federation one that would best protect its economic and military interests in Southeast Asia. Australia initially gave cautious support to this idea. It saw a new Malaysia as the means by which the region could maintain its pro-Western strategic orientation. Indonesia, however, although initially untroubled, grew ever more hostile towards the idea. Sukarno saw the creation of Malaysia as a neo-colonialist and neo-imperialist plot orchestrated by the British aimed at encircling Indonesia. Now keep in mind that at this time, under his guided democracy system, Sukarno was still trying to balance a number of forces domestically, and the Communist Party of Indonesia was the most powerful. The British were outraged at Sukarno's charges of being neo-colonialists, and were of the view that since Sukarno had taken over West New Guinea, he was now looking to assume control over the territories in Borneo, as well as the Portuguese colony in Timor. It would be fair to say that both sides were engaging in highly overblown and simplistic rhetoric. The crisis was sparked by an incident in December 1962 in Brunei, where the North Borneo National Army started a revolt. Now, these rebels opposed Malaysia, and the Indonesians were sympathetic to their cause. The extent of the Indonesian involvement is still unclear, but it is thought they helped to train the rebels. Now, in the end, the revolt was crushed by the British, but it was followed by a war of words between the Malaysians and the Indonesians. In January 1963, Indonesia declared a policy of confrontation, against Malaysia. And although the term was never really spelt out, comparisons were drawn with the Indonesian approach to West New Guinea. And it was assumed that it was basically a mix of military, economic, and political pressure. Now, the British were alarmed. They compared Sukarno with Hitler. They believed Sukarno wanted Indonesia to become a major Pacific power. They pointed to his arms buildup, which they said was supported by financial assistance from the Soviet Union. The Australian Foreign Affairs Minister at the time, or External Affairs Minister as it was still known then, Sir Garfield Barwick, told the Parliamentary Foreign Affairs Committee in Canberra that the creation of Malaysia was the best chance, he said, of creating a
bastion against China.
Australia's most urgent problem was to decide how to respond to Indonesia's Crush Malaysia campaign. And as I said, this had come to the fore just at the time that Indonesia had taken possession of West New Guinea. Now, Britain was pressing for Australian military assistance, but Australia was loath to commit itself. It had no desire to make a long-term enemy of its neighbour by precipitately becoming involved in a bloody war on its frontier. Even more, since Indonesia's militant stand had emerged just at the time when it was taking possession of West New Guinea, Australia was deeply troubled by the thought that if it intervened in Borneo, the Indonesians might retaliate by extending their guerrilla war to the Australian territory of New Guinea. With this in mind, they approached Washington to ask whether Australia could rely on the protection of the ANZUS Treaty if its territory or forces came under attack from the Indonesians. After all, America was responsible for the Indonesian acquisition of West New Guinea. In other words, before the Australians committed any troops, they wanted an American guarantee of their back door in Papua New Guinea. Now, after a meeting in October 1963 in the Oval Office of the White House in Washington with President Kennedy, Secretary of State Dean Rusk, and the Australian External Affairs Minister, Sir Garfield Barwick, a critical meeting, the Americans agreed to come to Australia's aid under the terms of ANZUS if the Indonesians attacked Australian armed forces. The American side placed so many conditions on their consent that in the end, in the given circumstances, it basically emptied the agreement of any real meaning. The Americans required that Australia should consult with them before sending troops to Borneo. Furthermore, the promise of American aid would apply only to a conventional military attack on Australian forces and not to a guerrilla war. And lastly, in the event of the Australians invoking the agreement, that is, invoking ANZUS, US assistance would be limited to air, naval, and logistical support. They also said that the US attitude would be influenced by Australia's, quote, other activities in Southeast Asia, i.e. that Australia would participate in and encourage New Zealand as well to join in American support for the Republic of Vietnam. Now, basically, the Americans, and specifically their Secretary of State, had put the Australians on notice that American support under the ANZUS Treaty in the Malaysian-Indonesian conflict was dependent both on Australia's willingness to take a leading role in restraining the Indonesians and on Australian support for the United States in Vietnam. Now, it is important to note that the United States was at one with Britain and Australia in approving the formation of Malaysia. It also encouraged the British in its armed resistance to the Indonesians' program of confrontation. And in 1963 and 1964, joint discussions between the United States, Britain, Australia, and New Zealand were tried to work out a common policy. But the UK, the US, and Australia had different concerns. While they all wished to protect Malaysia, the three powers had somewhat different priorities and approaches. For the United Kingdom, the creation of Malaysia was the final act in freeing itself from its empire in the region. The British government resented greatly Sukarno's efforts to frustrate what had been worked out so carefully with Malaya and Singapore. It had no intention of leaving the region without seeing the Federation successfully launched. For them, it was a matter of honour. The Americans, looking at the problem in the context of the global ideological conflict, the Cold War, could not but believe that Sukarno shared their fear of communism, both in the region and in his own state. They therefore were confident that he would be open to reason in settling the dispute. They thought that he could be made amenable if only a proper face-saving formula could be found and a suitable amount of economic aid offered to sweeten the deal. By the end of 1963, the Americans already had 10,000 troops in South Vietnam. It had no desire to become involved in another guerrilla war in a region which was of only marginal importance in its global confrontation with the Sino-Soviet bloc. By contrast, Australia saw Indonesia as the most important country in the region. Indonesia was the country most able to do it harm. In May 1963, following the news of the first Indonesian guerrilla incursions into British Borneo, the Australian Cabinet approved increases in the regular army from 21,000 to 33,000. 100 Mirage fighters were acquired for the Royal Australian Air Force, and even more significantly, the government decided to acquire F-111 fighter bombers from the United States, which would give Australia the ability to reach Jakarta from Darwin and to strike at targets throughout Java. Here's the key point. The very sense of vulnerability that produced these defence initiatives also caused the government to refrain from taking any provocative actions. Despite British pressure, Australia at first was very reluctant to allow its military forces to be sent to Borneo. Similarly, Australia was very active in seeking a diplomatic solution. The Department of External Affairs was assiduous in urging other Asian powers, such as Japan and the Philippines, to intercede with the warring parties. So the key point here too is that Australia's main priority was to allow Malaysia to come into existence without exciting blanket opposition from Indonesia. Now again, this is an independent Australian policy, and although it wasn't successful, it is important to stress the independence of it. For example, Garfield Barwick, in expressing the government's support for Malaysia, emphasised the need to avoid what he called
facile judgments
when reading what the leaders of neighbouring countries had said.
It is easy to say this man talks like Mussolini, or if the British Foreign Secretary said this, it would mean war. It does not follow automatically that things said by our neighbours mean to them what they would mean if said in a European context.
And he expressed sympathy for peoples that had gained their independence, namely Sukarno. And this was contrasted by what one historian called Robert Menzies' essentially European thinking and being out of sympathy with Asia. Barwick was doing his level best not to create a breach with Jakarta over Indonesia. And as with West New Guinea, the press reacted hysterically with the charge that this was appeasement. Following, however, Sukarno's famous Year of Living Dangerously speech in August 1964, in which he denounced
neo-imperialist encirclement of Indonesia,
confrontation reached a new level of intensity. Sukarno launched attacks on the Malayan Peninsula. In January 1965, the United Nations elected Malaysia to the Security Council, thereby giving its blessing to Malaysian claims to the British colonies. Outraged, Sukarno took Indonesia out of the UN and formed a Beijing-Jakarta axis, uniting the pariah communist states of East Asia, including, in addition to China and Indonesia, North Korea and North Vietnam. These were the so-called new emerging forces, as they were known, engaged in resisting the encircling imperialists. Australia could not but think that the situation was reaching a point where the application of diplomatic caution was not working. And to this end, in October, the government had introduced conscription. And under its terms, Conscripted soldiers would be able to be sent wherever the government believed it was necessary to defend Australian interests. So conscription was brought in with Indonesia in mind, and the Labor Party offered no opposition. In January of 1965, the government sent the Royal Australian Regiment, 3rd Battalion, to join the British forces in Borneo in fighting the Indonesian insurgents. By sheer accident, in September of 1965, a communist-inspired coup, which induced an army counter-coup, led to the fall of Sukarno and the rise to power of a military regime. This new anti-communist regime, led by General Suharto, carried out a purge of communists and their sympathisers and supporters. A great number of Indonesians, some say as many as 500,000, were massacred. The United States, Britain and Australia welcomed the new regime, and within a year, it ended confrontation and imposed a military-based order on the country, which encouraged Western investment and regional cooperation. It is interesting to note in passing that the death of President Suharto in January 2008 brought forth much discussion about whether or not he had been a positive influence on Indonesia and indeed on Australia's relations with Indonesia. The former Labor Prime Minister Paul Keating argued that Australia's post-war history would have been very different but for Suharto, claiming that
the past 40 years we've been spending roughly 2% of GDP on defence, about $20 billion a year in today's dollars. The figure would be more like 7 to 8 times that, about $150 billion today, if Indonesia had become a fractured, politically stricken state.
Keating argued further that
had Suharto's New Order government not displaced the Sukarno government and the massive PKI Communist Party, a communist-dominated Indonesia would have destabilised Australia and all of Southeast Asia.
Now, I think clearly what Keating was trying to get to the point of here was why Australians have continued to view Indonesia suspiciously. And his point was that the whole relationship for so long was seen through the prism of East Timor and Indonesia's annexation of East Timor in 1975. That is a topic I will deal with more fully towards the end of this series. The Indonesian confrontation was reaching its most violent stage at the very moment that the survival of the Saigon regime in South Vietnam was at risk. At the end of 1964, America had come to recognise that it would either have to take full responsibility for the war or abandon South Vietnam to the communists. The Australian government regarded it as imperative that the US should not surrender South Vietnam. It believed that behind all these insurgencies disturbing the peace of the region lay the expansionist ambitions of communist China. If Vietnam fell, the Menzies government foresaw an inevitable domino effect which would bring communist China to the frontiers of Australia. For the foreseeable future, as the then Minister for External Affairs, Paul Hasluck, put it, a Western presence, particularly that represented by the strength of America, was essential. Moreover, Australia's interests lay in having an American military force established on the Asian mainland. It would act as a barrier to prevent China linking up with Sukarno's Indonesia and therefore doubling the threat to Australia. In late 1964, Paul Hasluck sent an instruction to all overseas missions that the United States should be encouraged to remain in South Vietnam. The Australian government pressed the Americans to continue the fight. They indicated their support for greatly increased military operations and promised that Australia would be willing to play its part. The Australians were not being drawn into the Vietnam War by blind loyalty to their great power protector, but as a result of their own assessment, even if a flawed one, of Australia's interests in the region. As historian David McLean has argued, Australians chose dependence independently. Thus, in April 1965, when the United States had committed combat troops to Vietnam and asked Australia for a contribution, the government immediately offered a battalion. In doing so, Prime Minister Menzies declared that
the takeover of SVN would be a direct military threat to Australia and all the countries of South and Southeast Asia. It must be seen as part of a thrust by Communist China between the Indian and Pacific Oceans.
As the Vietnam War took on a new life and Australia in the following 2 years increased its commitment to 8,000 men, alongside what was at its height America's 500,000 strong army, the United States-Australia relationship took on new meaning. Australia and New Zealand were the only powers who freely contributed troops to the cause. The United States' European partners in the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, or CETO, well, they remained on the sidelines. Harold Holt, who had succeeded Menzies as Prime Minister, on his first visit to Washington, adapted the Democratic Party's presidential election slogan and famously declared to President Johnson that Australia was
a staunch friend that will be all the way with LBJ.
Now, just to digress for a moment, you will recall that similar momentous foreign policy statements by previous Australian prime ministers, for example, Andrew Fisher, who talked of supporting Britain to the last man and the last shilling in the First World War, John Curtin, with his famous Look to America statement of December 1941. On each occasion, these kinds of statements were followed by quick clarifications, which have often been forgotten by the history books. Fisher, for example, said that Australia's first duty was to provide for its own defence, and that if it had anything else left, it would offer it as a tribute to the mother country. John Curtin, in the days after his Look to America statement, went on to the national press and said, "This is not in any way meant to diminish our affection or our regard for Great Britain. Australia is still a British country." Now, Harold Holt, too, defended this all the way with LBJ remark as a reflection of Australia's real interests rather than as a simple switch of subservience from Britain to the United States. When he spoke to a moral rearmament conference in Melbourne in 1967, Holt said,
"When I say that we are all the way with America in Vietnam, that doesn't imply that we don't have an independent mind and judgment on some of these great international questions."
But this couldn't mask still Australia's fundamental dependence on its great and powerful friends. As the historian Gordon Greenwood noted,
"Men feeling their way in a swamp of uncertainty are wise to be sure of the ground on which they tread before they take the next step."
Lyndon Johnson reciprocated by paying a visit to Australia in October 1966. He was the first incumbent president to do so. The American alliance at this time seemed unshakable and beyond question or criticism. In the 1966 election, one of the very few elections in Australia fought over foreign policy issues, the ALP attack on the war was its undoing. At the end of the year, the coalition parties under Holt's leadership won a great victory at the polls. But that was the only victory that the government could achieve in the name of Vietnam. In the Tet Offensive of 1968, the Viet Cong were able to invade the cities of South Vietnam, and the Americans, while they managed to repel this challenge, suffered a great blow to their morale. President Johnson refused to accede to the demands of the generals for yet more troops and resources. Costs were too great. In effect, he signalled that America was ready to give up the struggle. With the election of President Nixon in 1969, the US began a massive withdrawal of its forces and accepted terms for their complete withdrawal in the January 1973 Accords. And Australia withdrew its forces step by step with the Americans. It should, however, be noted that the American decisions to give up the fight, to withdraw their forces, and to reach terms with the enemy were carried out without any prior discussions with the Australians. When defeat appeared on the horizon, what happened to the much-heralded intimate alliance? Equally, it could be asked, when defeat appeared, what happened to the falling dominoes? This brings me to consider, even if very summarily, the wisdom of the Australian involvement in the Vietnam War. For this purpose, it is worth considering the speech which the Australian Labor Party leader Arthur Corwell made in answer to Menzies on the occasion of the government's commitment of combat troops to Vietnam. This, in my view, is one of the few almost great political speeches in Australian history. It was written by his speechwriter Graham Freudenberg. Now, I can only summarise it very briefly here. In opposing Menzies' decision to send Australian troops in April 1965, Corwell declared that the government's policy was fundamentally flawed. Its decision rested on three false assumptions, he said. First, the government had an erroneous view of the war in Vietnam. That is, the war was, as the CIA reports had told the Americans, essentially a civil war and not part of a Chinese design to gain control of Southeast Asia. This, as Corwell said, was simple-mindedly to see
the very map of Asia itself becoming a conspiracy of geography against Australia.
Secondly, the government did not understand the nature of the communist challenge in Vietnam. That is, that the Vietnamese communists were not puppets of Moscow or Beijing, but rather the leaders of a nationalist movement which promised to deal with the legitimate social and economic problems of the Vietnamese people. And lastly, the Australian government, by encouraging the Americans to enter the war, was based on a false notion as to the interests of America and her allies. By intervening in the war, the Americans had lost credibility in the international arena. The commitment of such great resources to the conflict had weakened America's ability to meet real threats to Western interests should Moscow or Beijing take advantage of its preoccupation with South Vietnam. The high costs of the war and the prospect of an American defeat made it likely that the United States would be less willing in the future to sacrifice its treasure and troops in the defence of its allies, including Australia. The proper role for Australia when it saw that its powerful ally was being tempted for the wrong reasons and with potentially disastrous consequences to enter the war was to warn against such folly, not to compound it. Now, Corwell, in closing this important address in the Parliament, called out to the members of his own party directly.
"The course we have agreed to take today is fraught with difficulty. I cannot promise you that easy popularity can be bought in times like these, nor are we looking for it. We are doing our duty as we see it. When the drums beat and the trumpets sound, the voice of reason and right can be heard in the land only with difficulty. But if we are to have the courage of our convictions, then we must do our best to make that voice heard. I offer you the probability that you will be traduced, that your motives will be called into question. But I also offer you the sure and certain knowledge that we will be vindicated, that generations to come will record with gratitude that when a reckless government willfully endangered the security of this nation, the voice of the ALP was heard, strong and clear, on the side of sanity and in the cause of humanity and in the interests of Australia's security."
Looking back then, we can see that Australia did adjust in many ways to its new regional environment. It did understand that it had to come to terms with the non-communist Asian nation states and deal with them on their own terms. The old racial language was discarded. It adopted a new neighbourly language in describing these regional partners. Especially in dealing with the fraught problems of Indonesia, Canberra showed great restraint and wisdom in not allowing differences, even extreme ones such as guerrilla attacks on West New Guinea and against Malaysia, to lead to the kinds of stereotyping of the enemy which normally accompanies international conflicts. Thus, at no point, even when Australian soldiers were engaged in battle in the jungles of Borneo with Indonesian troops, did the Australian government break diplomatic relations, send Indonesian students and other residents home, or cease to give Colombo economic and educational aid to the Indonesians. Indeed, the government went to some trouble to convince the press not to demonise the Indonesian enemy. Australia knew it had to live in the long term with Indonesia, and therefore wanted these disputes and conflicts not to have a lasting effect on the relationship. And in this, they were very successful. But at the same time, it also wanted to secure a region that was friendly to the West and under the influence of its great and powerful friends. To this extent, Australia did identify itself with the global ideological struggle and see the necessity of keeping the British and the Americans in the region to oppose communist-led nationalist movements. But this era was not, in the end, very reassuring for Australia and its desire to look to its great Western allies for its future security. The confrontation with Indonesia was Britain's last hurrah. Following that conflict, the United Kingdom began its rapid withdrawal from east of Suez, that is, from Southeast Asia. It was no longer to play a part in the region. As for the United States, by making its role in the region an ideological function of its global confrontation with the Sino-Soviet bloc, lost credibility and belief in itself. After its defeat in the Vietnam War, it gave up trying to exercise a positive role in the shaping of Southeast Asia. Indeed, the defeat in Vietnam was such a shock that America not only withdrew its forces from the mainland of Southeast Asia, but also reappraised its alliances and warned its allies of the limits of the help they could expect from the United States. In one sense, as we'll see in future episodes, the defeat of the United States in Vietnam meant the end of the Cold War in Southeast Asia and the emergence of a new Asia totally free of Western domination. And it's in the light of those great changes that Australia in the 1970s and 1980s adopted a totally new approach to its Asian neighbours.
would also like to acknowledge the Indigenous peoples for over 60,000 years who lived on, loved and dreamt about the lands on which I am speaking today. And I pay my respects to their present and future successors who continue to embody their affection for Australia and their enthusiasm for its well-being. This series is produced by Peter Adams for the School of Humanities at the University of Sydney.